Welcome to the Health Fix Podcast, where health junkies get their weekly fix of tips, tools, and techniques to have limitless energy, sharp minds, and fit physiques for life. Hey, health junkies. On this episode of the Health Fix Podcast, I'm interviewing Dr. David Deiser. He's a naturopathic doctor just like me. He is out of Vancouver, British Columbia, and he is one of the founders of Noble Naturopathic. He is also a podcast host as well, the host of Personalized by Vitamin Lab. And I was on his podcast not too long ago, so hope you can check that out. But today we're going to be talking about metabolism. We're going to be talking about high-tech testing, such as the PNOE metabolic testing. We're going to be talking about working out fitness, how that plays in, resting metabolic rates. We're going to get a little geeky, but trust me, it's going to be fun, and you're going to get a sense of what you can do if you're fed up with where your metabolism's at and you really want to hone in on things. Dr. David has the answers. So let's introduce you to Dr. David Deiser. Hey guys, welcome to the Health Fix Podcast. I have Dr. David Deiser on, and I'm really excited because I did a podcast with him, Personalized by Vitamin Lab. And we had a great conversation on that. And I was like, oh yes, let's talk about your specialties. So here we are. So Dr. David, welcome to the Health Fix Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Janine. Really grateful to be here.
Well, you know, you have such a broad range of experience, and in particular, the metabolism school. We got to talk about that because it's probably the number one thing that women over 40 come to me about. They're like, hey, I'm seeing things slow down. It's not cool. I don't want to gain weight. My body's looking different than it used to. Help. And so anybody who is focusing on, let's say, saving women from their own madness, hands, high fives, thumbs up. I'm all about it. So tell us a little bit about you in terms of becoming a naturopath. I'm always curious about other naturopaths. What brought you to the bright side of medicine?
Thanks for asking. So I wanted to be a physician my whole life. I wanted to work in medicine, help as many people as I possibly could ever since I was young. But when I became an adult, I realized that my interest didn't sort of align with the conventional pathways. And so I had experience working in a chiropractor's office when I was young. I had many family members who benefited from alternative care, typically in cancer care, really. And when I was in the Navy, I still did want to be a physician. I wanted to be a naval physician. But at the time, it didn't suit the pathway for me. It wasn't going to be happening. And so I was living in Victoria, where naturopathic medicine is really, really popular. And I met a few people, loved what they were doing, learned that they were doing manipulation, they were doing adjustments, learned that they were practicing primary care in our province, and also learned that they were, you know, doing evidence-based natural care. So I had sort of like the benefit of all three. I could work in physical medicine, I could be a primary care provider and help a ton of people, but then also I could help people stay away from medications as much as possible. And so I ended up applying, got in, went for it, and then right away jumped into sort of like integrative cancer care, because that's what benefited my family so much. And I got a ton out of that. And I felt like I was able to help a lot of people very early on in my career, which was really cool.
Isn't it funny how a lot of us come in from cancer care? That's kind of how I came into the naturopathic world, didn't know anything about it. And same thing with acupuncture, I had no idea. And that's the interesting thing about the physical medicine side of things. You can see, you know, the immediate results, you can feel people's energy, you can work with them on that level. And gosh, it's just so fun to hear other people's stories and how you came to it. Now, you had mentioned before we hit record that you grew up just on the border of New Brunswick and Nova Scotia. Were you having to travel very far with the family to see naturopaths there? How did it work? Because I know at this point, you know, there's more naturopaths in Nova Scotia, but I'm guessing back then there's maybe less. Like, tell us the story.
Not many or none. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I know. Yeah. We're talking about 15, 20 years ago now. They were traveling. My family members were traveling to Moncton, New Brunswick, to an apothecary. So they were traveling to receive herbal medicines from a sort of like a natural pharmacy place.
Very cool. Yeah. And that's the story I hear a lot for folks in different provinces in Canada, even today, you know, they're all, it's kind of spread out. I mean, even in Wisconsin, we don't have a lot of naturopaths. You know, Washington State, West Coast, definitely, like you said, lots of naturopaths in Victoria, Vancouver, you know, those areas. But sometimes it's a little bit few and far between. So I'd love to hear kind of how folks connect with.
Oh my gosh, for sure. And I work on a street in Vancouver with the most naturopaths of any street, I think, in North America. So I like completely opposite. The one street where everyone said not to work on is where I ended up working on because it just suited my lifestyle. So, you know, it's kind of unfortunate that it's really difficult for naturopathic physicians to open practices in small towns, but it's building. It's really building, becoming more popular in Nova Scotia, all across the Maritimes, really, and Atlantic Canada in general. There's a lot more naturopaths now, which is really cool.
I'm excited to see it. I love the growth. I love to see that people are embracing it, but also just that, you know, our word is getting out, right? And you have such a unique, let's say, like, program that you have, and especially skill sets where you're combining fitness, which absolutely love, and then also working in metabolism, working in some of the IV therapy. And so, guys, we're going to talk about that a little bit more today. What got you into wanting to work with metabolism as a whole and creating the metabolism school?
Well, I have kind of a funny story. Like I was an athlete in college. I played basketball for the Royal Military College of Canada back when we were in the university league. And we had an opportunity to play against some of your great schools and get our ourselves beat pretty badly. We play, actually had an opportunity to play against West Virginia, which was really cool, D1 school, which was really fun. I think we got beat by 60 points. Anyways, after college, of course, I was at the Royal Military College where we trained all day. It was very physical. I was a sort of like a 400 club athlete, which is someone who reaches all the athletic pillars, basically. So we were training all day long. And then I was playing varsity basketball in the evenings. And after college, all that output went basically to zero as I entered in a naturopathic school. You know what the demands are like. It's very, very intense. The output went down to like a short walk, you know, kind of like at the end of the day. And I gained 50 pounds and I had been an athlete my entire life. In fact, I want to talk about my athletic journey as a high school athlete as well, because it kind of ties into metabolism school a bit, but I had been an athlete my entire life. And I was then 50 pounds overweight and I could not believe it. And I said to one of my professors in naturopathic school, I said, I can't believe this is happening. Like, I am eating less than I was eating before, because we had unlimited food. It was military college. It was a well-funded program in the country. Unlimited food. Everyone ate all day long. And everyone was very lean, of course, because we were training so much. And then to gain 50 pounds, I thought, this is wild. I was actually studying chemistry and I was in biochemistry. I knew all about metabolism at the time, but didn't consider how impactful actual metabolic rate is on your like sort of like lifestyle. Like, what happens when you go from training 4 hours a day to training zero? What happens when you go from eating unlimited food to eating what really ended up being a small amount of food? What happens to the body? And so I think I lost a bunch of muscle and gained a bunch of fat. And that really inspired me to think more deeply about metabolism. And of course, we were training for longevity and for prevention. Is one of the tenets of naturopathic medicine is to consider prevention, of course. And so we were talking about the role of obesity, how it's related to disease and how it leads to disease. And I was freaked out. And so I got right into tightening up my metabolism, of course, lost all the weight. And it's, you know, my career has sort of been focused on that kind of in the second half. I'm 10 years in. The second half of my career has been heavily focused on helping people with their metabolic rate.
Isn't it funny how you like kind of like get the career started and then you evolve into like what you initially were like, yes, this is why I'm doing this kind of thing. It's
yeah. Oh, totally. Completely. It's really cool in our medicine, though, that we get to have these different kind of pathways within our career. Like, you know, 20 to 30% of my day is still integrative cancer care, but there's like a metabolism piece to it, because we measure their metabolic rate and we help them eat enough so that they don't lose, so they don't experience the sarcopenia of what happens in conventional care.
Yeah.
So we know how much calorie they need to be eating, and we know how much protein they need to be eating. We can track it. We can track the impacts of metabolism, impacts of chemotherapy and radiation on actual metabolic rate. So we have this pathway where we can do that, but then we can support people with weight loss. But then also, what about chronic disease? Well, we're talking about obesity, so there's a weight loss piece, but also the fittest people live the longest regardless.
Right.
And so we have this pathway that's sort of the chronic disease prevention, chronic disease treatment pathway, where we still are able to use the metabolism device. So it's like my career has just become so fun. It's the best.
I love it. I love it. You're still in the game at the beginning. Now you get the, yeah, it's neat to see how you incorporate it and it like evolves over time. Now, one of the things that struck me in terms of your programs that you have is that you have this technology known as PNOE metabolic testing. And I had to look it up because I was like, huh, what does that mean? I hadn't heard of it before. So can you explain to folks kind of what PNOE testing is? I'm pretty sure that a lot of folks haven't heard about that before. They're thinking blood tests. They're thinking maybe like a DEXA scan to see what their body fat percentage is. Give us a scoop.
Absolutely. Well, in other countries, physiologists have their own practices and they measure metabolic rate. It's just typically the device is connected to the computer. So for example, at all the major universities across our country, the physiology departments have metabolism assessments device. Devices. You breathe into it, it measures how much carbon dioxide you exhale. Mm-hmm. But it's going through a tube and the sensors are telling the computer live what's happening with your carbon dioxide exhaled. The only difference with this device, and there's a series of other devices like it out there, it's Bluetooth. So it does a data dump every 30 seconds. So the sensor's attached to the mask, it goes to a pack on the person's back, and the actual measurement is completed there, and the data is sent via Bluetooth to the computer every 30 seconds. So I don't get a live stream of data. I get these batches of data that are dumped. Okay. But it's the same as your conventional metabolism analysis devices. It's just mobile. So I was first excited about it because the American Heart Association said that I think it's in Atherosclerosis in 2017, they published that the people with the highest VO2 max live the longest regardless of their cholesterol, blood pressure, and blood sugar status. And then there's a line after that says, oh, and it can be tested in office. And I knew that there's a physiologist at our hospital here who measures metabolic rate, but I never figured out like, how do people see that person? And it can be tested in office. So I thought, how? Looked it up right away, found this Bluetooth device I've got right into it. This was just over 3 years ago now. So now we've tested 700 people's different metabolisms, both at rest and during exercise. So we have this like insane amount of metabolism information, like actual real life stuff that I can come on shows like yours and talk about. And it's been really cool.
That's neat. So over 700 people, you must be seeing some trends. You must mm-hmm. be seeing kind of some data outputs. Are you guys doing any research or writing any papers or anything, or just kind of taking the info in and utilizing it to help?
Oh, I wish we were doing research. Yeah, I wish we were. No, we're not. We don't have the capacity yet. We have two people trained and a third one coming soon, a second location opening up. And then hopefully that will give us some space to be more organized and to consider projects like that. But right now we're just sharing information within the group so that we can help the people that we're seeing as much as possible. But yes, we've seen some trends, my goodness. And it may be like your very typical trends. I guess the key thing that people come in for is they feel like their metabolism has declined. And then they come in, we measure it, and they say, yes, we say yes or no. But also we get to say, if it's a no, why do we think that's happened? Just through like a few questions. I'm sure you can imagine them. Do you sleep well? What are your hormones like? What's your stress been like? And have you had any nutrient deficiencies? Like we can kind of check the boxes. That's aside from diseases and disorders, of course. Sure. But then if it's normal, then we can show them what a meal plan looks like. That's a deficit if they're trying to lose. So they can know exactly what the portions should be to see if they've actually done it before.
Mm-hmm.
If the physician says, move more and eat less, all of a sudden we have a program in front of them that shows them what that actually means and provides predictable weight loss. This morning, person came in, they're 11 or they're 7 weeks out of their since they did their test. We were supposed to meet after 8 weeks, but we ended up meeting a week early. We did 6 pounds per month, so we were expecting 12 pounds, but it's been 7 weeks and they're down 11. Like exactly 35-year-old female, exactly lost. the amount that we predicted they would lose with the deficit that we created. It's unbelievable. It's so cool.
Wow. That's neat. That's neat. 'Cause I mean, a lot of us, right, we're kind of guessing, and I even have a device here called the Lumen that measures the carbon dioxide. And so folks could do this at home, but I still feel like even with the home devices, it seems that there's still a lot of questions if there's not someone with you all the time kind of helping. And I shouldn't say all the time, it's not like you're following your people around, but you know, having someone guide you in terms of the information that you guys get and the actual, like, this is what you should be
The
eating.
accountability piece is huge. There's two real pieces, right? There's the evidence piece, like you laid there for 10 minutes, and then we took the smoothest 2 minutes of your breathing to determine exactly what your resting rate is over the course of 24 hours at its lowest. And then we're able to compare that to the basal metabolic rate, which would be sort of like the predicted resting rate and tell you if you're a good burner or a bad burner. But then also there's a plan to suit it. So if the metabolism is normal, here's a plan that's going to be appropriate. You don't have to count calories. You just follow the portion sizes. So what I'm trying to do with this idea of metabolism school is I'm trying to bring the educational piece to the world. Like, here's what we know about metabolism so far. Here's the impact of thyroid hormone. Here's the impact of having low iron. What does it mean to train every second day to your actual resting rate? Like, what does that do? So if we pull out all these educational pieces, I think that we could have this metabolism forward or metabolism first lifestyle that can be incredibly supportive. And even if say a person believes their metabolic rate is low but can't doesn't have access to this test, well, that's fine. If you follow the educational pieces, you can kind of check all the boxes, right? Like you can check the testosterone box, you can check the estrogen box, you can check the 8 hours of sleep box, the stress reduction box. You check all these boxes, and then like not fasting, for example, consuming enough protein, strength training, doing cardio every second day. Like you check all these boxes, all of a sudden there's nothing else that could have been done for your metabolic rate anyways. So then you can go with the predicted values. And that's the idea. I want to have this educational piece that really supports the public for people who won't have access to this test.
Gotcha. Okay. So independent of the test, you can still do this. Now, I think what a lot of people are kind of looking at in terms of the metabolism is what I heard you mention testosterone and thyroid. A lot of people are like, what kind of testing do I really need in terms of things? Are you guys doing blood tests? Are you doing saliva? Are you doing urine tests for the hormones? Kind of what's your like gamut of testing for metabolism focused types of clients?
Oh yeah, that's cool. We have access to all of them, of course, and we use all of them. So we individualize the care. You know me. My whole theme is like personalize, individualize. That's my whole thing. That's why I love my podcast, because I get to talk about ask people how they personalize their care. But when it comes to hormone testing, we absolutely personalize care, and we only will go in all in on testing if someone has a low metabolism. Like this is the example where someone's trying to lose weight and can't. Right. So they come in, like for other people who have actual low hormone symptoms, of course we test. But let's say someone's coming in and they suspect they have low metabolism and they haven't been able to lose weight. And then we do the resting test and it turns out their metabolism is low. Like we predicted it using the Harris-Benedict equation at 1800 calories per day, but it actually came back at 1600 or 1500 calories per day. Well, then we have to go into the, we have to have some sort of line of questioning. Like we have to figure out how to best allocate resources for testing. So say when someone has symptoms of low testosterone, low libido, low sex drive, for example, they have, they used to have more muscle mass, they feel like they're weakened. Then it could be valuable to test testosterone. And there's a few ways of doing it. Like we'll use a simple blood test for total T if we just need to have like a basic assessment, but of course we'll do saliva testing and urine testing if we want something a little more detailed. We want to go for bioavailable. If we want to go for the actual metabolites of testosterone to see the whole cascade, we do the urine test. But very commonly, what's happening is we're seeing women whose estrogens have gone low, say for example in menopause, and their weight has gone up, and so it's can be very valuable if they have a low metabolic rate to have a look at estrogen progesterone because they do play a role. And so we do a lot of that. And we'll use in that circumstance either saliva or urine, depending on the amount of information that we need. If they have symptoms that would require us to know about the different progesterone metabolites, for example, whether it was some stress symptoms or some insomnia type symptoms, or if we needed to know more about the estrogens, like there was a genetic predisposition to, for example, increased estrogen levels of one of the three types, or increased estrogen receptors or metabolites, then we may want to consider looking at those because it's a really, really good test to see the whole picture, obviously.
Yeah. No, I think it's important to test. I think it's important to kind of have some of the info at hand, right? So what we're working with, obviously none of us, treat specifically on just the test. We treat the person, but the data is helpful in this case. Now, when it comes to exercise and fitness, and say you've got someone who is athletic, maybe they play college sports, maybe they're playing pickleball right now since that seems to be all the rage, or they're trying to stay active and they're like, man, I'm physically moving every day and I my am I just not doing enough intensity? Am I doing too much? How do you guys gauge that based on the PNOE metabolic testing? Are you looking at resting heart rate? How does that work? How does that factor in?
Are they trying to get fitter or lose weight, or what is the deal? Like, what is the end goal for them? Like, we typically start with that, right? Like, the VO2 max test that we do with the device gives us our VO2 max, the max amount of oxygen they can consume at their peak, milliliters per minute divided by their kgs of body weight. So body weight does play a role in VO2 max, by the way. You want to be fit and lean. But we also get nine other metrics. So we're looking at measures of oxygen consumed divided by the heart rate. So as the heart rate rises, the consumption of oxygen should rise at a certain rate. We get to see their tidal volume, like how much they can pull in per breath and how fast they breathe during exercise. We get to see the efficiency of breath at the end of the test. So when they're breathing super fast, how much oxygen the body's actually consuming. It tells us a bit about the lung, a heart, muscle connection. We get to see metabolic scores for calorie burn. So we see about metabolic efficiency at the low end, like whether they're burning too many calories or not enough calories at the low end. And then again at the high end for mechanical efficiency, like they're going all out. Are they burning 30 calories a minute? Like, is it outrageous, an outrageous level of calorie burn? And then we also get to see the recovery capacity. So when we do a ramp test, this is a ramp test to exhaustion, we get to see if they're in the first minute of cool down, if the heart rate comes down 30 beats. And then if the second minute they clear all the carbon dioxide that was built up in the body. So we get all these different metrics. And say someone who is trying to be better at pickleball, then we get to pick, okay, it's classified for us as limitations. The physiology team will classify the scores. These are lab-derived scores, except the VO2 max as evidence-based, obviously. But all the other scores are lab-derived, but it's a good lab. They give us limitations. What we would predict for someone, same age, height, and gender. And then we get to work on those limitations. So for example, for an agility sport like pickleball, we're typically thinking, can you express this power, this ability to get to the ball at the end of the event in the same way you could at the start of the event? Well, that requires a significant level of endurance. You need to have this aerobic capacity to do the same amount of work at the end so that you can recover those ATP stores, so you can recover the creatine bonds, so you can express those when times are tough. You don't want to be fatigued. Well, the device tells us if your low-end cardio is not good enough, depending on your fat burning versus carb burning in the first few minutes. Say you have an endurance sport. Well, so endurance sport, we can go for what is the actual heart rate that's in zone two and how much fat is actually being consumed for fuel in that heart rate. And so what we do for our endurance athletes is we try and shift that thing all the way to the right so they're burning fat at as fast of a pace as they possibly can be. And it's the worst for them when they switch over to carb stores too early. They get fatigued. It's unbelievable. So they say, train slow to run fast. Well, we train really, really slow for them for very long periods of time, and they get more efficient at burning fat. So we find the limitations and we program. On the weight loss side, we just find how many calories they're burning at every heart rate and say, if you train here for this number of hours, we can add that on to the deficit. And while you're doing that, hopefully we're picking something that's not going to make you hungry and tired. But if it does, message us and we can change it. And so that's kind of how we program the calorie burn side of things.
Okay. So it's a little trial and error, which, with anything,
We're gonna have that. And I think that's really important for folks to hear that there's gonna be some, it's not like you're gonna get this data and that's the end all be all. There has to be a little bit of playing back and forth to see, which direction things might go.
Well, it tells us though. It's the coolest thing. Sorry, Jenny. It tells us exactly which direction to go. The question is, can we send the right stimulus for that person? So, for example, say it tells us that, their fat burning efficiency at low intensities is not good enough. No, they need to train as much as possible during the week at low intensities without losing their fast twitch muscle fibers. Like that was my problem in high school. Like I wanted to dunk the basketball. I wanted to be able to do this. And so I bought all the jump programs that were available in the 90s. Like that was my thing. I bought them and I did them because my discipline was insane. I followed them very closely, but I also ran cross country and I trained at night. So I did the plyometrics. I did the heavy, heavy weights. I did all the leg work during the day, but then I kept up my cross country times. I ran 3K every single night and longer runs on the weekend, up to half marathon runs, and did really well in cross country. Of course, my genetics, put me in a position where I had a ton of slow twitch muscle fibers. I kept those and I developed them. And I never gave my body a chance to adapt to the stimuli I was sending it during the day. I never built the fast twitch muscle fibers. I never was able to dunk the basketball, even though I found evidence-based strategies to do that. I had good resources, but it never worked for me because I was sending two signals. So we always want to be sending the right signal at the right time. We don't do endurance training on the same day as zone five sprints because it wipes it out. We don't do weight training on the same day as zone five sprints because it wipes out the benefit of the zone five sprints. So we're able to get the limitations from the test and then take an evidence-based approach to programming, which is minimum 2 days a week on its own of the stimulus you're trying to send. For some people, that is enough. For some people, it's not enough. So the trial ends up being like, what is the actual volume and intensity at which you need to create this stimulus? And that, of course, is easy to iterate as you go because you can just ramp up something and tone down something else. That's why I became a strength and conditioning coach too, to try to like be able to figure out when to turn the dials in which way. And that's been super, super valuable, combining that kind of approach with the data from the test.
Gotcha. Okay, now I understand a little bit better. Because, yes, I think for a lot of people, that is a big question. Am I overdoing it? Am I not doing enough? How many days should I be doing things? What do I combine together? And for endurance and for strength and for improving in a sport, that's completely different than someone who's like, I just want to target fat loss. And so in terms of fat loss, could you give us an example of what that would look like in terms of someone looking at zone training, looking at combining, looking at,
Absolutely. No, totally. Like whenever it comes to fitness, we have to individualize the programming, of course. But fat loss individualized programming is highly dependent on your ability to follow the nutritional deficit. Like the most important thing is a nutritional deficit because we program 70% of the results, 70% of that calorie deficit from the meal plan. So it really, the exercise calorie burn is quite minimal when you look at the actual total volume. Say, for example, we have a resting rate of 1500 and a daily activity burn of 500 because they have sort of like a desk job, which is everyone. And then we have an exercise burn. Say we're doing 4 days at 400 calories per day. Then we would take that 1600 divided by over the 7 days to get about 200 calories per day and add that onto the total. So now we're at 2200. If we want to lose a pound and a half a week, we have to eat 750 less. So we're programming there. That's where we're programming. So we're staying at that 750 less than the total daily energy expenditure, whatever it takes to stay in that. So let's say that 400 calories that we thought we were going to get from exercise 4 days a week is something that we have time for and we can do. If a person is really well trained, then we take their limitations and say the best choice for you would be to train for these limitations because it's going to help you get fitter and you're going to get the right amount of calories. Say they needed to do some zone four tempos. They're doing equal amounts of zone four and zone two because in zone four, it's kind of short. They don't tolerate lactic acid well enough. We should train there. Well, here's the calorie burn that's going to happen. And the benefit of doing zone four training is you're going to have a significant afterburn. for the next 48 hours, the resting rate is going to be higher than we found today, which means the results are going to be like a little better, but also it might make you hungry. So you got to check in with that. Let's say, for example, within this whole thing, we had someone who had a low muscle mass and they were eating, we had them eating at 1450. We had them eating at 1450, but their muscle mass is low. So there's a risk here. We have to work on building their muscle so that we can make sure that their metabolism is going to stay strong when they reach their goal. We don't want them to lose muscle, to go from a low state to an even lower state. So they need to strength train. So we have to send this signal to the muscles that we need them to be growing. And we can do that in a deficit. We found that out many, many times here. It's unbelievable the results that we've had turning fat into muscle, hypothetically, but it actually shows up on the page, which is so incredibly cool. So we have to train for that. So the stimuli would be 2 to 3 times a week for every muscle group. So that can end up looking like full body 3 days a week. For someone who's never trained before, now they've got the bands, right? They're going through the bands and doing some band work at home 3 days a week, and then walking for the rest of the calorie burn, something like that, so that it's not making them too hungry because the weight training might make them hungry. Mm-hmm. So we have to individualize it. From a metabolism standpoint, we can get afterburn from more intense work. We risk the hunger and the fatigue because we're eating in a deficit, remember. For the untrained person or the person with low muscle mass, we have this responsibility to make sure their metabolism comes out at least the same or better when they reach their goal, so that maintenance is really easy. And that means that they're going to need to be participating in strength training of some sort. They could work with a trainer. We have one who we send people to. But really, it's about sending the right stimulus. So for a lot of people, it ends up being like dance class, or it ends up being like spin class, or whatever they can do to start integrating something that is signal sending to the muscle tissue that we want to send to. And all of that will lead to fat burning because they're in a deficit. Now, if we look at just fat burning, like during the movement, it's only low intensity movement that causes fat burning. Like unless you're going to run for like over an hour and then you burn through the glycogen stores and then you start tapping into fat again. But there's a lot of other complications that come with that one. So for fat burning, we just look at low intensity work. So the device spits out the fat max. So we get to see at what heart rate they're burning the most fat and how many calories they would get at that heart rate. That's what body composition pros do. You know, they just lift weights and then they just walk for 3 hours on an incline. That's what they do. And it works like crazy. It works so well, but who has that kind of time? So for the person who's like looking to see, you know, now is not the time for me to get fitter. I'm just trying to reach this goal to prevent cardiovascular disease from the obesity that I'm suffering from. Well, let's walk on an incline for as much as possible just to maximize that fat burning, not worry about afterburn. We have the test with 24 hours of no exercise. So we get to see what the resting rate is like there. We're not really considering afterburn. We're just making sure they're burning fat during their exercise. So we do that. Lots, lots.
Hmm. I think one of the things I'm hearing that there may be some confusion out there, and maybe some folks who are listening might be like, wait, you said that you're going to have me burn fat in a deficit. And I would love for you to help clear up some confusion, because on social media, there's a lot of folks saying you can't be in it. You don't want to be in a deficit, because if you're in a deficit, it's going to go negative on you and you're not going to get the results that you need. Help folks kind of through that a little bit in terms of why someone might say that online and really what is truly happening, what you've seen with your clients.
Oh, with like really long-term lack of eating. But I mean, it's pretty rare to have your metabolism go down because you're not eating enough, right? It doesn't happen in a short period of time. That's for sure. Mm-hmm. So it happens when you lose muscle mass. It happens when the mitochondrial function declines, because we have some levers we can pull. Mm-hmm. We have mitochondrial function. We have mitochondrial density, informed somewhat by the muscle mass, like the actual total volume of muscle. Mm-hmm. So let's go through some examples. Some people can fast for long periods of time and their metabolism stays really good. Some people, they fast for a day and we're seeing declines. It's going down. Yeah. And it's incredibly individual. think about these mitochondria and think about their function. Like, we have lots of data about improving mitochondrial function. Do cardio, train high intensities, train low intensities. Mitochondrial function will get better. But we don't talk enough about mitochondrial decline, whether it be from nutrient deficiency or from inactivity. Right. We have some people here who have metabolisms that are 500 calories less than predicted who do not have hypothyroidism or are medicated appropriately and their TSH, T3, and T4 are optimal. Like, we have that. We have a few who are like have resting rates less than 1,000 and, you know, should be 1,400 or 1,500, but all of the biomarkers that we would check their disease for are normal. So mitochondrial function is like this real wild card. So let's go through some examples. It's super easy for men to maintain muscle mass. It's easy. We're carrying around bigger bodies. And so we're sending a bigger stimulus just by getting up out of the chair, right? So the muscles are getting more stimulus with the movements that we have. We have more testosterone. It's easier for us to do. But still, when men fast, sometimes their metabolism goes down. For women, it's probably a little quicker. It's probably a little bit faster in my experience. And that may be for all those, the opposite of the reasons I just shared about men. Totally risky to be doing fasting for long periods of time if you don't have a body composition scale, if you're not tracking your muscle mass, if you're not subjectively journaling your energy and how you're functioning. So we do this. We do this, right? Like, let's say what do we have for mitochondrial function? We measure lactic acid here in the practice. So we have some people with chronic fatigue syndrome. When we prick their finger, check the lactate level, it's high. It's high. They're making too much lactic acid. It's like they're sprinting, but they're at rest. The mitochondria are not doing their thing. There's probably something up with the mitochondria. But what if you're at home? How are you checking in on this? Well, you need to stay strong. Have to stay strong. You have to keep the muscle mass. And then also the energy has to stay pretty good. So the question really is about how are we going through the nuances of online physician, very clear statements like this happens to everyone. No, we have to know that that is absolutely not true. We have some people here who think their metabolism's in the tank, but it's actually optimal and they've been eating too much for a very long time. And it's, they're eating less than what their partner's eating. So it doesn't feel like they're eating too much, but maybe their partner's metabolism is like way different than theirs. But everyone's mitochondria are unique, just like the rest of us are unique. It's just these little organelles have significant control over how much energy we're producing and expending.
It's good that you say that. And I was hoping that was where you're going to go with the mitochondria, because that's where I come down to with a lot of folks, and there's so many gurus out there. You got to fast, you got to fast, you got to do this amount of fast. Everybody does the same thing. And I'm like, I don't find that to be as good of a blanket statement of everyone does the same thing. It is individualized and definitely, toxicity levels, methylation, things of that nature. I'm guessing you go down those rabbit holes with folks too, when you're kind of looking at someone's metabolism that's a little wonky, when you're like, huh, what's up here? Tell us a little bit about how those play into someone's metabolism, especially methylation as a whole.
Oh, I mean, great question. Yeah, I don't have a ton of experience. Although I do work in this realm occasionally, I don't have enough experience to feel confident in any one statement, because I've seen people respond incredibly well to your typical protocols and other people respond incredibly poorly to what we would call your typical protocols as poor methylators. I find that it's really difficult to know exactly what to do for the person in front of me. And so I sort of keep an arm's length from it. In my metabolism experience, I haven't had a ton of need to actually think about the genetics of methylation, only on the hormone side of things, on the detoxification side of things. But typically the person who's coming to me needs to know how little to eat and how much to move. And so we make a program that fits that. on the other part of my day, like the other 50% of my part of my day, when people have serious anxiety and they've already had the test done, well, then I feel like I can comment on it a little bit. But other than that, I try to stay away.
It's an interesting thing that you mentioned that because I think a lot of folks, when they feel like their metabolism is broken, they will dive towards the most intricate aspects of the mitochondria and get in the weeds. You know, what type of B12 should I be taking? You know, this and that. I've also seen different pathways of folks going right into IV therapy to try to reboot mitochondria. I would love for you to speak to that a little bit too, because I know you said you kind of keep an arm's length, but I would love to hear kind of what, you know, how you're using IV therapy and how you explain it to folks about metabolism and how that plays into things.
Definitely. I would say I keep an arm's length from the methylation conversation when talking about metabolism, but IV therapy, I'm all about. It's amazing. Yeah, so but I would say like before that, the thing that we focus on when people are unsure what to do for the mitochondria is cardio. Like it's running. It's if you can't run, it's biking. If you can't bike, it's recumbent bike. If you can't do that, it's a dance class. It's like something that you can do for cardio because that increases mitochondrial function. Then we have to think about if the mitochondria has enough resources. So, you know, I use IV therapy in chronic fatigue syndrome and for people who have incredibly low metabolisms and get good benefit from it. I see it as a bridge. It's a bridge to getting enough nutrients in through the digestive tract because that takes time. Sometimes there's damage. Sometimes there's inefficient absorption and we have to work on it and it can take months. And so IV therapy really is a bridge to that. We don't have a standard IV program for everyone. We customize, individualize the programming. We go based on how people are feeling and we try to give ourselves time to optimize for absorption. That's how I approach it.
Gotcha. And say someone's digestive system is doing okay, and you've done some of the metabolic testing in terms of, let's say, an oat test, you know, or a NutriEval by Genova, something like that. Those of you guys who are listening that don't know what I'm saying, organic acids testing is one of the ways we look at vitamin and minerals. We look at what the mitochondria are doing in terms of breakdown of your fat, proteins, and carbs. But when you use this, are you also, in some cases, supporting cut with custom vitamins using Vitamin Lab basically for customization on that, like someone's, let's say, a custom multivitamin or a custom mitochondrial formula for an individual?
We do it all the time. I use Vitamin Lab so much. Of course, if anyone isn't familiar, Vitamin Lab is a sponsor of my podcast, Personalized, and I just love them so much. We use all the professional brands in our practice, but we use Vitamin Lab a lot for those custom formulas following one of those tests you're describing. And I see it as being incredibly valuable. For one, it saves people money. And for another, you're avoiding all the things that you really may not need. And that can make a significant difference for the mitochondria. As you know, with the oat test, you get to see the organic acids assessment. You get to see if there's some imbalance in the metabolites that would be present, for example, in your mitochondria. And what's happening in the Krebs cycle is sort of elucidated by this assessment. And if something is overdone, if you consume too much of one nutrient, one of the cofactors, you can find that this whole process is hung up. Now, it's pretty rare. It's pretty rare. This is separate from this really ends up being separate from the typical weight loss program that we make. 99% of our weight loss, not 99, 90% of our weight loss programs is like pretty cut and dry. Metabolism is just about normal. Here's the deficit. Follow this, get used to these portion sizes and do it for this number of weeks, and you'll be good to go. The other, say, 10%, okay, there's something else happening here that we need to think about. And sometimes we catch things. And I love the organic acids test for that. And I do think that it informs the protocol really, really well. Rather than just saying, like, here's L-carnitine, alpha-lipoic acids, and B vitamins, NAC and CoQ10, just go for it. We get a good idea of exactly what to do. And I love that.
Yeah, I find it refreshing to hear that it's the basics, really, 90% of the time. And I think a lot of people, like I mentioned earlier, we tend to think What are all the things that are broken? You know, it can't be what I'm eating. I've tried that. I've done this. I've done that. And so oftentimes I will get a little pushback from folks when they go, oh, you're just going to tell me what to eat and how to eat it. That's not going to do it. I've done that. So I'd love to hear kind of, you know, obviously you've got the testing to back you up, right? Versus someone just recommending, like, here's your macros and it's off the top of their head, right? They're just guessing. You know, and I'll be honest, like in the beginning of my career, I did do a lot of that because I was working on, you know, in a fitness kind of realm, and we would just kind of eyeball it at first, but you have the data behind it. So when you have the data behind it and you're telling folks like, hey, really, it is just this, do you also, because I know you have a comprehensive program, are you also combining the exercise or will you just do nutrition first?
No, we
And
do both. We do
okay.
both. Absolutely. Because we want to benefit. We want to benefit from the calorie burn during exercise, but we also want to get fitter. We have this data. We might as well use it. But I would say, even for people who didn't have the data, let's say before I did this, I just did low carb plans. Like that was my whole thing. Low carb and fasting for like 7 years. And 50% of people lost weight incredibly effectively and did so well. And it was great. But the other 50% of people, like, what is this? This doesn't work. Like, this is we're just estimating, we're just guessing, we're just trying some restriction thing, and I feel worse off. So what am I supposed to do? So now let's say I'm in a scenario where I can't test. There are situations where we can't do that. And how would I counsel someone? Well, we have the predicted metabolisms, right? We have the predicted calorie burn. We always predict daily activities anyways, and then we could predict exercise calorie burn. All the treadmills do it, all the watches do it. So we can get an idea, we can get a ballpark. That's what people like a lot of online fitness people, what they do for weight loss, right? Is they take your weight, you multiply that by 10, that's the number of calories you should eat if you want to lose, multiply by 12 for maintenance. That's the kind of thing that people do. We can take the estimated calorie burn, but then we can take all the strategies to optimize for metabolism. And so let's go like low hanging fruit here. I don't want to make it sound too easy because correcting an iron deficiency is not easy.
No.
Building an activity pattern, right? Building this daily movement pattern that either increases your daily activity output so we can then estimate higher, or actually is dedicated exercise so we can add on something new. That's not easy. I was recently talking to someone who Dr. Gupta is a weight loss physician, and he talks about activity patterns. He talks about like, what are you doing? What is your daily movement like? So I compete on the Apple Watch with 5,000 other people for calorie burn. That's the only way I can do it because I'm an athlete in my heart. And if I'm not competing, I'm not moving. I'm sitting behind this desk. It's unbelievable. So we have to figure out what is that thing for you that is going to get you afterburn? How are we going to pull this one lever? That's not easy. That's not easy. Some things are just a given, right? Like menopause is happening. Before menopause, the actual loss of metabolism is really only related to muscle loss. Like over large epidemiologic trials, metabolic rates decline with muscle loss before the age, I think it's before the age of 50. After 50, it's 1% per year, which is not zero. This is aside from muscle loss, but it's not zero, but it is something. So I would suggest that for some, like because that's an average, for some people, it's way more pronounced. It can feel like it needs to be supported. So we can measure that. And if we're not in the office, of course, we can just take it seriously and act upon it. So I don't want to be like, spend this whole time with you making it sound like it's really easy. Just measure and do this, do that. No, these are things that can be done at home. Sleeping through the night can be worked on. It has a significant impact on metabolism. It has an impact day to day. When people do recurrent metabolism tests, the actual variability is only 50 calories. So the tests are incredibly accurate, but let's say that's it. That's all other variables the same. Let's say someone didn't sleep through the night or has a viral infection. Their metabolism is way different the following day. Like it's totally different, their resting rate. And so we have to consider that other things are happening. So we can tie all these up, and it can be very difficult. You say, well, I sleep better, but how do I do that? Well, that could take like 3 months to figure out. But then once we figure it out, it's amazing because metabolism goes up and everything becomes easier. So that's why I'm saying, like, we could check the boxes. We can go through these. And just following people online who feel like they have all the answers, like, I don't claim to have all the answers. I claim to have a list of things that could be optimized. And when we optimize all of them, I do think things get better, and I have the luxury of measuring to make sure things get better. One of the easiest ones is fitness. You know, like, we have done so many tests for athletes now. This whole stream is like taking off. Everyone wants to know their VO2 max, which is really cool. They burn more calories at rest. Athletes do. Their resting rates are higher, but their calorie burn during exercise is lower. At a heart rate of 100, they're only burning 4 calories a minute. Everybody else is burning 6. So it's very obvious that having this fitness first thing, where it's like, we have this data for VO2 max. Maybe we should actually try and get fitter first. Well, we're going to get the value of the calorie burn, whatever. That's great. We're going to get the afterburn. But also, what's going to happen long term is the resting rate is going to be better. And we're going to be able to challenge ourselves at higher intensities during the exercise. And that's going to be good for a whole assortment of things, including hormone.
I think definitely intensity is something that we overlook. I think in especially in fitness, it is something that's overlooked, especially with the hormones status and seeing where someone is on that level for sure. And just kind of one of the things you were mentioning as you were talking about it's not easy, is you had mentioned a viral illness. And sometimes we'll have folks that'll have an acute one, of course, that'll mess with your metabolism. But what about the folks who have the chronic reactivated mono? Chronic reactivated CMV, which would be your chronic fatigue patients, of course. But I will sometimes see people that have these and they still work out like on a regular basis, but intensity trashes them. How would you approach, what do you know, obviously you're going to do the same kind of testing, things of that nature. What would you say to someone like that who's like, I know I have a chronic viral thing going on. I haven't kicked it. I need to figure that out. What would be your approach in that case?
Well, we measured lactate at rest, and that I think provides a ton of value because you can then start something that's supporting the appropriate macronutrient usage. So let's say, for example, we're finding someone has elevated lactate at rest, and it's present on some of the organic gases tests as well. But like, I like testing with the meter and just having this like live thing. I think it provides a ton of value because we can consider the supportive care for example, fat burning and glycogen usage. But what are the lifestyle aspects that go into that? Well, in this scenario, the immune system is overactive, and if we have any challenging work, then all of a sudden there can be post-exertional malaise, and that really impacts someone. Well, we have seen people's metabolisms decline over time in conditions like this because of the deconditioning. Typically, when someone has a viral infection or any sort of immune response, or let's say an autoimmune flare, or even a cortisol response for mental emotional stress, acutely, their metabolisms go up. Chronically, their metabolisms go down. So we try to think about that and take and use the framework we have to be metabolism supportive. How many people have chronic viral infections who don't have a normal iron store? Like, my understanding here is that the chronic fatigue provincial practice shoots for a ferritin of 100. Like, they're not shooting for 50. So like, I'm more conventionally, there are some metrics that are being used to support people. They test vitamin D here in chronic viral infections. They optimize for this, and everybody comes back low. So when someone comes in and they have been through this kind of like torturous thing. We can't just say, you know, go to an exercise. We don't even really do the ramp test because it can throw you out for a whole week. But we do have personalized care. We're looking at, say, the most common nutrient deficiencies, iron, vitamin D, B12. And we're finding that very often they're not what we would call optimized. And I'm saying optimized partially from a conventional standpoint because I know the program is doing certain things with ferritin, and then optimized from a basic lab standpoint. Our labs have vitamin D set. Our metrics are different than yours in the States, but normal vitamin D is 75. And pretty much everyone in British Columbia who doesn't take vitamin D is below 75. So, you know, we always find something that we can be working on. We do a lot of like nutrient assessments, and yes, we find low carnitine. Like we find it. One of the biggest ones is the recommendations for protein intake. Like, you know, we have a recommendation here of decimal 8 grams per kg, but then they want us to exercise for 150 minutes per week. But then if we're exercising for 150 minutes per week, well, are we entering into more of an athletic requirement for protein? So we've got the Canadian Society for Nutrition suggesting that maybe an appropriate recommendation might be between 1.2 and 1.6 grams per kg. And so we're like, well, maybe it's glutamine. Maybe the immune system really needs a ton of glutamine when it's been burdened by an infection. So we do a ton of amino acid therapy. Yes, we do the protein therapy. We make plans so you know what the portion sizes are, but that's tough. Like it's kind of gross how much protein you have to eat sometimes to get your body back in order. But glutamine can make a big difference. I feel like I'm a naturopath from the 1990s. It's amazing. It's so cool. So all of a sudden now we're combining glutamine and D-mannose and L-carnitine, and people's metabolisms are getting better. We do a lot of iodine tests, which is kind of wild because like the main cause of hypothyroidism in North America is Hashimoto's disease. But then we measure urinary iodine and find that it's low a lot. And you know, the thyroid hormones are looking pretty good, like not too bad. Too much iodine is terribly toxic and make a person so sick. But how cool is it to catch it on a test, support it, and have a person feel a lot better? Now, I think it's John Hopkins that says that 50% of Americans are deficient in magnesium, and Health Canada, I think they said recently that 30% of Canadians. If we're not getting enough magnesium, oh, and I looked at my own requirements for sodium, it's like 2 grams a day. No way I'm getting 2 grams a day of sodium. These requirements, there's no way the food is deficient in mineral. We're all doing certain things with our diet and trying to get fancy with things and finding that, well, okay, maybe we're like fully deficient in like 10 things. So long-winded answer to say that we always find something to work on, and very often working on that thing or that group of things makes a big difference.
No, I think, you know, it goes back to the title of your podcast, Personalized, right? And we've gotten so far away from personalized. We have all this one size fits all, of course, in the modern medical model. And I think a lot of us are stuck in that thought process. So we watch different folks on Instagram, we watch different gurus, and they're telling us like everybody responds the same. And I think that's the most important takeaway I really want folks to think about during this podcast is that we all have individualized things going down. And we all have our own different, you know, deficiencies, different things happening. Now, when it comes to mitochondria, you had mentioned the, you know, training and training folks to be fitter and using that as kind of like a jumping point. And that's kind of one of my main jams for everybody. I want folks to consider, okay, so you may be gaining weight. All right, let's take the weight out of the picture and really think about like, did anyone, you know, on their deathbed say like, I really wished I'd lost that 10 pounds, right? No one's gonna say that. And I'm sure you have been down this pathway with folks, you know. I think a lot of folks would say, I really wish I enjoyed my last 10 years of my life because I could do XYZ, right? And so at the crux of metabolism work, the mitochondria, ultimately, at the end of the day, you're improving mitochondrial function and helping folks, you know, move forward. So I wanted to kind of loop it back to that in terms of the longevity side of things here and why it's so important to think beyond the I want to lose weight for the metabolism. Speak to that to folks. Help us spread the message of yes, weight loss is nice, but living a really amazing life is so much better.
Definitely. Well, so many things to pull out here. Like the first is that I've taken all those longevity supplements and they make me starving. I can't, like, they make me more hungry than exercise. If I take NR, nicotinamide riboside, or CoQ10, I can't stop eating. I just can't. I have to keep going. And so I feel like they could have a place, but for me, oh my goodness, I don't know if they're just really, I gotta measure my resting rate before and after to see what kind of impact they're having on it. But they make me very hungry. So, well, I come from a town where there's like most of our towns, there's lots of cancer, there's lots of cardiovascular disease. I work in a practice where I try to help people prevent those. But I see and I know a lot of people who have been through chronic disease, whether it be in my own family with rare cancers or non-rare cancers, or in my practice, when people pass away from something that's preventable, it's torture. It's super torture. So what I try to talk to, what I try to speak to really when I'm making these programs is the benefit that actually is possible. What can you get from this? And part of the thing I bring it back to is the energy produced, the actual metabolism that athletes have at rest. Their metabolic rates are higher. They're actually making more energy. We're measuring the byproducts. And they feel good. And it's difficult to stay in tune with what feeling good actually is when you have felt bad for a very long time, or you have been sort of like what would be considered suboptimal. And I'm not saying like we're life hacking our way here, or life hacking life away. I'm saying like there are some things that can be done that could make a person feel really, really good. And part of that feeling is coming from improved mitochondrial function. It's actually mitochondrial function enhancement. And the strategies that are recommended by our governments are actually pretty good. Like 150 minutes of moderate intensity per week is a pretty good recommendation. 2.5 hours divided whatever way you like. The question is like, what's moderate activity for a person? And what would be the detriment of training less or less intense? And what would be the detriment of training more? How would that make a physiologic difference? What would that stimulus do? And so I like to speak to those things. Here's how we should spend our 2.5 hours right now. Let's do it over here. Let's build 2 pounds of muscle in 2 months. If we do that, then in the next 2 months, then we have this opportunity to improve our VO2 max significantly through two things, through expressing that muscle at higher intensities and through losing a bit of weight. Oxygen consumed per minute divided by your kgs of body weight. And then we know now we're in this different group, and all we did was follow their recommendations. We're just dividing up this time in different ways. If you're trying to lose weight, walk on an incline and eat less calories than you're burning. Okay, fine. We should measure your resting rate afterwards. By the way, we just had someone lose their first, we had our first person lose 100 pounds.
Nice.
15 months. Really cool. So proud of her. Metabolic rate went down 250 calories, resting rate. And so they lost 100 pounds of fat, 5 pounds of muscle in 15 months. So pretty happy with that muscle loss. Like that's not bad at all. Their metabolic rate went down 250 calories at rest. And that's pretty good, to go from 1600 to 1350 for their height. 1350 is actually normal. So, I'm pretty happy with that. Fat is not that active. It's not active. Muscle is incredibly active, and it's active for a couple ways. Like it you have to move it. So your body has to make more energy to move it because it's pretty heavy, and it packs in a ton of mitochondria. So we can improve the density of mitochondria. And when we talk about mitochondrial function, we're really not talking about the organ systems. We're talking about the muscle mitochondria. That's really what we're describing. So when we think about it that way, like, okay, the fat is not making much energy in total. You can lose 100 pounds and your metabolism is going to be like still normal for your height. That's wild. The muscle mass is doing a lot of the lifting here. it's doing a lot of the actual, it's having a lot of the actual influence. And so there's two things we have to do. We have to have a normal amount, which we would call like above the 100th percentile, basically, is what we're looking for. I have an in-body scale, but all the scales have like a normal level of muscle that you can kind of shoot for. And the scales at home are fine too, as long as you're tracking the trend. Like they're doing the lower legs only, I think. But the trend is what's important. If it's going in the right direction, okay, it's working. But then, so we have that, but then we can think about the fact that yes, we're having to move them, but also their actual ability to produce energy is dependent on nutrient, but it's also dependent on the signaling, which is quite complex. Oxygen to the tissues, nervous system intent, intending on actually making movements, all of that comes into play. So I love talking about this. I love teaching about all this. I think it's really, really fun, and people get a lot out of it. So from a longevity standpoint, we kind of bring it back to that. We're not all going to be athletes, but it's a spectrum. It really is. And higher VO2 max, people with higher VO2 maxes typically feel good. Like they feel really good at rest, and that's ridiculously important. So I like to speak to that as much as possible.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because I think we're missing the boat a lot, unfortunately, on mitochondria, on metabolism. We're stuck in the wrong place and not thinking about where, as society, right? Unfortunately, it's all about the weight loss, but we're not thinking about all the other cool things that can happen with our body to really optimize things and what it could be like.
Definitely. You could just be fitness first and you could be protein first. You could be doing that. And it doesn't have to be meat protein. My wife's a vegan. My kids are vegetarian. You know, I'm a pescatarian. We're all about plant proteins. But when we're trying to make a change, whether it be body composition change or fitness change, it's easiest if you think protein first and then build around and then fitness first and then track hunger and cravings and energy and go from there. And that's been the, like, I think the biggest insight for the people that I've worked with is like, if we just keep those two things top of mind, then it's easier to stay on track.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I think at this point, we've given folks a really great idea of what you're up to in the office and what you're doing with Metabolism School. I would love for you to kind of explain how folks can work with you, how they can dip their toes in. Even like, do you take folks if they come visit from out of country? Like, give us the story of how it goes and we'll go from there.
Definitely. I'm in Vancouver, British Columbia. People come and see me from all over the world. People come into the office because Vancouver is quite a popular city to travel to. But if you haven't been able to get your metabolism checked or your VO2 max checked and you've got a visit booked with Vancouver, of course you can see us. It's all primary care here in the naturopathic world. So people come all the time and we work with them when they're in the office here. For education, from an educational standpoint, I teach continuing education for the nutrition school. But I also have my own thing online that I'm building to try to teach these pillars. I'm trying to teach the boxes that we need to check. And that can be found, the sign up can be found at noblenaturopathic.com/metabolism. So noble, NOBLE, naturopathic.com/metabolism. There's a little sign up space there if you want to hear about how we're going to be helping people check these boxes just from an educational piece. So that's really cool. And then if you want to hear more of what we're talking about, of course, my podcast is called Personalize, and I interview people sort of like you and I.
Absolutely. And that's anywhere you can find podcasts too, correct?
It is.
Okay, perfect. I want folks to hear that as well. Now, I'm always curious, Noble Naturopathic, where'd the name come from? Give us the scoop.
Oh, we like the ring of it. It sounds great. But also, we're trying to be evidence-based and we're really good team members. So we objective data, check the box, right? Good team member, good listeners. The whole group of people here are just like lovely and very responsive and think outside the box and are incredibly supportive and holistic. And so we thought that it would be a good name for the clinic. My son's middle name is Noble, and we just like the ring, and it resonates with people in our office. We have a lot of people who choose naturopathic medicine for their primary care because it's difficult to find a physician here, and people really resonate with it because we know when to use medications and we know when not to use them, and we're pretty good at teaching why we made the decisions that we made. So we thought it'd be a good name to fit that kind of approach.
I like it. I like it. That's awesome. So, folks, if you're listening to this podcast and you're in the Vancouver, British Columbia area, now you know where to find a primary care physician that aligns with your mission. But also, if you're struggling with your metabolism, you've got some help here too. And sounds like all the cancer care as well. So, we've got all kinds of things you guys are up to. And we didn't even talk about cold laser. That's probably going to be another podcast for another time at this point. But these guys are doing a lot of stuff. Check out their website, and that way you'll see more. And I'll put all the information in our podcast notes at drjkrausnd.com. My goodness, so much stuff. So if there is one thing, and I think you kind of already said it, but I just want to reiterate it. If someone's listening to this and they're like, I really want to get started on my metabolism right now and see if I can get like a leg up before I get a professional on board, what's one thing they can do to get started?
We test people frequently because I'm super interested in how metabolism changes. When you train, when you exercise on purpose for just under an hour, you'll find that your metabolic rate is higher for the next couple of days. That may be, in my experience, 100 to 200 calories higher at rest in the following 24 hours, maybe a little less in the 48 hours. But it's something to work with. If you think your metabolism's slow, you can boost it a little bit by training every second day for an hour. If you get hungry from the training, you might want to try a different type of training. If it's making you overeat, it might be something to check in with. So, exercising on purpose, we're not talking about the stairs in your building or walking around. Those are all really good, and activity patterns are super, super important. Think about them as activity patterns, patterns of daily living. That's why I like competing for calorie burn on the Apple Watch. But purposeful exercise on purpose every second day in whatever way you like, whatever way you'll do, and watch your metabolism rise up a little bit.
Awesome. All right, folks, you heard it here. You know what to do to get started. And of course, if you want to continue moving on with your metabolism, you can head over to noblenaturopathic.com and then it's /metabolism if we want to look at metabolism school.
That's correct.
Got it. Dr. David, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. What a great time and great questions. I loved it.
My pleasure.
Hey, fellow health junkie. Thanks for listening to the Health Fix podcast. If you enjoyed tuning in, please help support me to get the word out about the podcast. Subscribe, rate, and review, and just get that word out. Thanks again for listening.